Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of evolutionary voices for the quantum age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience evolutionary voices for the quantum age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour with your host, Carolyn Baker.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost.
Welcome to the new Lifeboat Hour. I am recording this message for you today on November 22nd, 2016. This is my kind of annual message for the holiday season. And we are at very daunting times, as all of you know. You probably wouldn't be listening to this podcast if you didn't know that. And it was, in fact, 53 years ago today, on November 22nd, 1963, that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and many people who study world events and geopolitical situations continue to believe that that was a coup d'etat in the United States in which some people, and we have never really been able to determine exactly who, decided to take Kennedy out of the picture because he was interfering with things like the Vietnam War and other efforts that the powers that be wanted to make happen. So even though many of you listening to this podcast may not even have been born at that time, those of us who were alive at that moment remember. I certainly have never forgotten the significance of November 22nd. So it is on this day that I want to bring you an inspirational message for the holiday season. Most recently, my friend Andrew Harvey and I wrote an article called The Serpent and the Dove, Wisdom for Navigating the Future. And we wrote this specifically for Americans and for people anywhere who are concerned about the election results that took place November 8 of this year, just a few weeks ago. And at this moment, much of America and the world finds itself in a profound state of shock, for many people even disbelief, as we now have a president-elect named Donald Trump. Very few people would conclude that this has been a normal election or that Trump is a normal president-elect. In fact, Trump has made his claim to fame smashing the normal and doing what he wants to do and doing the non-traditional. That is part of what got him elected. But we're very aware, we should be aware, that millions of people in the United States were hurting and continue to hurt on a variety of levels. And they ached for some kind of political change. People who were burned by the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, people who are working minimum wage jobs, people who really understand that the ruling elite and the powers that be, the corporate culture, the corporate empire, has really, really shafted them. And they have been disenchanted with and often devastated by the old guard, the neoliberal globalist policies that screwed them and declared the well-being of corporations sacrosanct. And so a candidate who promised that he would make the demise of that system his personal mission in life was really, for many people, deliciously irresistible. Now, I also understand that due to the protracted dumbing down of American culture, that is, the deconstruction of education in the United States, a clear analysis of issues was not within the grasp of the average American unless they really put forth an effort to educate themselves accordingly. And even if they were willing to do that, what would be in it for them? There was an interesting article a few days ago by Gary Younge, carried by The Guardian, entitled How Trump Took Middle America. And he says, when people feel the system is broken, they vote for whoever promises to smash it. So really, in a sense, this vote for Trump was a cry for help, but at the same time, it was also similar to the frantic tantruming of a toddler just kind of flailing with rage and saying, we want change. We don't know what that looks like or what it's supposed to look like, but we want change just because we want change. Well, sadly, it's just a matter of time until the disaffected voters wake up and realize the extent to which they've been conned. You know, after all, Donald Trump is the con artist's con artist. Reporter Paul Waldman writes in the Washington Post, the greatest trick Donald Trump pulled was convincing voters he'd be anti-establishment. Well, maybe not the greatest trick, Waldman says, but in a campaign full of cons, it has to rank close to the top. This was near the heart of Trump's very special appeal to the disaffected and disempowered. In other words, send me to Washington and that establishment you've been hearing so much about, well, we'll blow it up and send it packing and punch it right in the face. And when it's over, the government will finally be working for you again. And the people who voted for Trump bought it. After all, they thought he's no politician, right? He's an outsider. He's a glass breaker. He's a guy who can cut out the bull and get things done, right? But the idea that he would do this was based on a profound misunderstanding of what the establishment, the system actually is, and a misunderstanding of who Donald Trump actually is. Sister Simone Campbell, who was one of the organizers a few years ago of Nuns on the Bus, wrote a wonderful article entitled, America Must Allow Its Heart to Break Before It Can Heal. And in that article, she says, as I traveled around the country in advance of the election, I heard stories from so many people. Among them were two white middle-aged men who were avid Trump supporters. They felt that though they had worked hard, they had not prospered the way they expected to. They also saw that their children were having even more difficulty than they were. These men felt betrayed by the American dream, and if you scratch the surface, a bit ashamed that they've not measured up. It now seems this shame fueled a blazing anger that is at the heart of Trump's electoral victory. But the anger is misdirected, and it will become increasingly toxic unless we can find a way to engage in conversation across the political chasm. Campbell goes on to say, this anger and vulnerability is the result of an economy shaped by trickle-down economics, which privileges the already wealthy at the expense of those in the middle and at the bottom. These Republican policies betrayed our people. But rather than holding the politicians who passed these policies accountable or turning their blame to the people who voted these politicians into office, some Americans instead blame the other. And that means immigrants, women, people of color, Democrats, whatever the other is to them. Well, I believe that Donald Trump is a far more dangerous example of proto-fascism than merely a triumphant proponent of populism. An enormous and terrifying aspect of America's dumbing down has been the adulteration of its educational system in all of its disciplines, and particularly with regard to history. Now, I was a professor of history and psychology in numerous colleges in recent years, And while I was teaching, I was appalled by the resemblance of many U.S. history textbooks with People magazine. They started to look like entertainment, driven by an entertainment-focused media. These so-called history textbooks were actually designed to distract rather than educate. And few Americans, I think, under the age of 50 have a grasp of fascism or the history of fascist movements in modern history. Hitler and the Holocaust continue to mesmerize our culture with horror, and yet a fundamental understanding of fascist ideology is absent. We believe, or I believe at least, that the election of Donald Trump, surrounded as it is by the primacy of corporate capitalism, emboldened by Tea Party ideology, mindlessly sanctioned by an uninformed electorate, and mirrored in numerous neo-fascist movements around the world, is a watershed moment in American history. In fact, the ideal combination of ingredients that is likely to result in a full-fledged fascist American state. There's a wonderful article written recently by Oxford professor James McDougall. He's a history professor at Oxford. The title of his articles is, "No, This Isn't the 1930s, But Yes, This Is Fascism." And with reference to the election of Donald Trump, he writes, "This is a new fascism, or at least near fascism, and the center-right is dangerously underestimating its potential, exactly as it did 80 years ago. Then, it was conservative anti-communists who believed they could tame and control the extremist fringe. Now, it is mainstream conservatives facing little electoral challenge from a left in disarray. They fear the drift of their own voters to more muscular anti-immigrant demagogues on the right. They accordingly espouse the right's priorities and accommodate its hate speech. They reassure everyone that they have things under control, even as the post-Cold War neoliberal order, like the war-damaged bourgeois golden age last century, sinks them under. The risk, at least for the West, is not a new world war, but merely a poisoned public life, a democracy reduced to the tyranny of tiny majorities who find emotional satisfaction in a violent, resentful rhetoric, while their narrowly elected leaders strip away their rights and persecute their neighbors." This from Oxford history professor James McDougall in an article, "No, This Isn't the 1930s, But Yes, This Is Fascism." I encourage you to Google that article and read the entire article. So how then shall those who understand the rise of fascist movements and their devastating consequences respond? Facing the likelihood of limitations on the freedom of our expression, freedom to protest, and even freedom of movement, what recourse do we have? Well, in the article that Andrew and I recently wrote, we suggested three possible responses. First of all, reconnection. Now, a lot of people right now from both political parties are talking about reconciliation. For example, Oprah Winfrey said on the day that Trump and President Obama first met together in the White House, she said, "I just saw President-elect Trump with President Obama in the White House, and it gave me hope." And then MSNBC anchor Chris Matthews, who has this very shrieking, high-pitched voice, said, "I'm just determined to find an optimistic note here. There's got to be a pony in this crap pile." In other words, what he was saying is we must move toward reconciliation and hope. But these statements by Winfrey and Matthews reveal a very, I think, irrational rush to provide an unearned uplift to the situation, a compulsion that seems to characterize American culture with its institutionalized, cheerful optimism. In fact, authentic exultation is not born from ignoring the horror of any situation, but from suffering it clearly without surrendering faith in the mysterious movement of the sacred. the sacred, that which we are in our essence. So what Oprah says and Chris Matthews says, these are the very reason that Andrew and I felt it was very important to redefine the word reconciliation. Because their vision of an unearned uplift brings to the situation a fake medicine in the name of healing that really masks for a time the symptoms and therefore prevents a cure. So even though attempts at reconciliation are important, we need to be very cautious because the word reconciliation isn't stringent enough. It isn't tough enough. The notion of reconciliation can easily continue the kind of comatose, fake inclusiveness that makes us vulnerable to deceit. We were aware as we wrote the article of the wise words of Jesus when he counsels his followers to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And in the current situation, we have to be very aware of New Age soppiness and let's love him no matter what sentimentality. We have to remember there's no authentic reconciliation without authentic discernment and without the other opening their arms. You know, Naomi Wolf, who's the author of The End of America and several other books, wrote a wonderful article in The Guardian a few years ago called Fascist America in 10 Easy Steps, in which she outlines the progression of fascism for which on many levels the stage has already been set. And as the malignancy of fascism advances, it usually does so gradually and seemingly harmoniously. But lacking the wisdom of serpents, the innocent revel in reconciliation, all the while chanting, well, let's at least give them a chance. But as Professor McDougall noted in that wonderful article, the spread of fascism, he says, in the 1920s was significantly aided by the fact that liberals and mainstream conservatives failed to take it seriously. Instead, they accommodated and normalized it. The center-right is doing the same today. Brexit, Trump, and the far-right ascendant across Europe indicate that talk of right-wing revolutionary moment is not exaggerated. And the French presidential election could not be next on the calendar. This is from Professor James McDougall. Also, CNN Republican commentator Ana Navarro states, it's hard to give Trump a chance when he staffs his White House with racists. Now, maybe some folks listening to me saw a couple of weeks ago the Saturday Night Live episode in which comedian Dave Chappelle hosted. And he said, he's an African-American comedian, he said that he was willing to give Donald Trump a chance, but he asked that Trump give him a chance as well. And it's really only in this kind of scenario that any authentic reconciliation can occur. Well, for all of these reasons, Andrew and I preferred to use the word reconnection as the first response that we have to make toward the rise of fascism. And this reconnection isn't even primarily focused on the adversary. Reconnection grounded in discernment can only occur when we're deeply connected with the sacred self inside of us, with the earth, and with other human beings and all living beings. Also, it's important that we be willing to dialogue with people of very different political perspectives. Michael Moore has brilliantly modeled this for us in his pre-election movie, Trump Land, in which he skillfully gathered a number of Trump and Clinton supporters together in a small theater in a small Ohio town, along with undecided voters. And he asked them to really talk about their concerns with authenticity and heart. It's a beautiful, beautiful experience of dialogue between people with very different opinions. It is on iTunes, and I encourage you to watch it, Trump Land by Michael Moore. When we stand on the ground of our own integrated empowerment, we become increasingly discerning and capable of bearing witness to the entire landscape before us, not merely observing the desirable qualities of the adversary that we selectively choose to perceive. So reconciliation or reconnection should be our first response to these, to the Trump victory. In our article, Andrew and I also stated that the second response should be resistance. I saw a wonderful interview recently with Masha Gessen, who wrote a fabulous article called Autocracy Rules for Survival. She grew up in Russia. She lived in autocracies most of her life, and she learned a few rules for salvaging one's sanity and self-respect while living in an autocracy. I'd like to share some of those rules with you. Rule number one is believe the autocrat. He means what he says. For all the admiration Trump has expressed for Putin, the two men are very different. If anything, there's even more reason to listen to everything Trump has said. He has no political establishment in which to fold himself following the campaign, and therefore no reason to shed his campaign rhetoric. So rule number one, believe what he says. Rule number two, do not be taken in by small signs of normality. Panic can be neutralized by falsely reassuring words about how the world as we know it has not ended. It is a fact that the world did not end on November 8th, nor at any previous time in history. And yet history has seen many catastrophes, and most of them unfolded over time. That time included many periods of relative calm. So rule number two that Masha Gessen shares with us, do not be taken in by small signs of normality. Rule number three, institutions will not save you. Now, of course, the United States has much stronger institutions than Germany did in the 1930s or that Russia has today. Both Clinton and Obama in their speeches stressed the importance and strength of these institutions. The problem, however, Gessen says, is that many of these institutions are enshrined in political culture rather than in law. And all of them, including the ones enshrined in law, depend on the good faith of all actors to fulfill their purpose and uphold the Constitution. Rule number four, be outraged. If you follow rule number one and believe that the autocrat elect is, believe what he's saying, you'll not be surprised. But in the face of the impulse to normalize, it's essential to maintain one's capacity for shock. This will lead people to call you unreasonable and hysterical and to accuse you of overreacting. Well, it's no fun to be the only hysterical person in the room, so prepare yourself. Now, when she says be outraged, she doesn't mean you have to go around yelling and screaming as if you're in a rage, but allow yourself to be moved, to be really shaken, I believe, by what has actually happened. Rule number five, don't make compromises. In an autocracy, politics as the art of the possible is in fact utterly amoral. Those who argue for cooperation will make the case, much as President Obama did in his speech, that cooperation is essential for the future. They'll be willfully ignoring the corrupting touch of autocracy from which the future must be protected. And finally, rule number six, remember the future. Remember the future. Nothing lasts forever. Donald Trump certainly will not. And Trumpism, to the extent that it is centered on Trump's persona, will not either. Those rules from Masha Gessen in a wonderful article entitled Autocracy Rules for Survival. You may want to Google that article and read it again. So the conclusion that we come to, Andrew and I, in terms of resistance is that we must resist because the consequences of 21st century fascism are unimaginably horrific. And this is really important. Unlike Germany's fascism of the 1930s, today we possess nuclear weapons, biological weapons, massive surveillance infrastructures, a gargantuan military-industrial complex that is controlled by dark money, and a servile media. We've never had fascism on Earth in this context. Now, I just referred to dark money. I said a military-industrial complex controlled by dark money. And in the article, I gave reference to Jane Mayer's wonderful book, Dark Money, in which she goes into this in detail. Anyone who really wants to understand our political landscape in the United States and what is actually happening behind the curtain should read Dark Money by Jane Mayer. On the other hand, we cannot and must not reconcile with the forces of evil. When we're talking about reconciliation, we must be careful. We can't reconcile with the forces of evil. And at the same time, if we try to resist violently, that will certainly be used to justify brutal retaliation. We saw that certainly with Hitler in Germany in the 1930s. And so this is why nonviolent resistance is so important. Now, while it's important to resist through external activism, it's equally important to resist through soul-searching inner activism. Andrew and I talk about in the article, we share a little bit about our own journeys with our parents. We both grew up in very conservative households. Andrew grew up in a household where his parents really believed the British Empire was humanity's salvation. I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian home where racism and use of the N-word were commonplace. And, there was a rabid belief in American exceptionalism. So both of us actually today in our older years have experienced significant reconciliations with our family, but it's come with a price. Because for all of our adult lives, we struggle with the question, and maybe you have struggled with this as well. How can our parents be good people at heart and yet be so hypocritical? The truth is that we have been and remain today in the fiery crucible of healing with our parents, healing with our families, healing with friends. And that fiery crucible of healing compels us to practice love, compassion, and forgiveness. Knowing our parents' stories and their trauma, their wounding, helps us make sense of their behavior. But we've come to understand in a very deep level why it is that so many people refuse to work on their own trauma. We have, for many years, experienced the wrenching toil of that work, and at the same time, the grace and glorious healing that can occur if one is willing to do that work. So, with or without the election of Donald Trump, the human species, I hope you all know, is annihilating planet Earth. Catastrophic climate change now has a life of its own, and it's being accelerated by the madness of humans who refuse to acknowledge its reality. Therefore, we must face the fact that business as usual is completely over. And this resistance of which we speak is a spiritual warriorhood. And in no way is it going to return us to business as usual, because there's no business as usual to return to. Both Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. were wise as serpents and harmless as doves, which was the source of their incomprehensible power. Likewise, the Dalai Lama has taught nonviolent resistance among Tibetans, really in order to avoid a terrible bloodbath, terrible violence. In this moment, the world is witnessing an unprecedented example of spiritual warriorhood in the civil disobedience at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. In a powerful article recently online, Melissa Hellman, who's an activist, reveals what civil disobedience at Standing Rock teaches us. We would add to her observations these important realities. Resistance is bolstered in our divine identity. This again, divine is not a religious term. It has to do with our core self, our spiritual being. Resistance is bolstered in our spiritual identity that resists the seduction of the darkness in ourselves and in the temptation and lies that a proto-fascist system might throw at us. Resistance at Standing Rock is a spiritual and moral act, as well as an environmental and political act. Secondly, as we see at Standing Rock, resistance is being defined as rioting, destruction of property, and in many cases, terrorism. It requires enormous courage and an unwillingness to compromise in the face of such false accusations. And thirdly, we can be part of an organized mass movement of nonviolent protest grounded in the deepest spiritual principles of compassion, modeled on Martin Luther King Jr., the Dalai Lama, Gandhi, and Polish labor activist Lech Walesa. This kind of resistance that holds a high moral ground is blessed by invisible powers and has an extraordinary capacity to shift the situation. One of the points that we make in talking about resistance is that the sacred leader or the sacred activist is like a warrior slash midwife. The warrior defends the eternal laws of justice and compassion with courage, passion, stamina, and radical discernment. A midwife evolves and enacts the strategic canniness, patience, and inclusiveness to implement the birth of the eternal laws of justice and compassion in reality. So we're using the words warrior midwife because what is required is a marriage of the sacred masculine and the sacred feminine. Being one or the other isn't sufficient. But suffusing both will give us the power, wisdom, and strength to go forward. Now, this requires, in order for us to bring together the warrior and the midwife, it requires three marriages to take place in the core of our being. First, we must marry a profound realization of our inner divine identity with the selfless acceptance of our particular historical mission in time. Self-realization without shouldering the mission in time leads to passivity. And conversely, shouldering our mission in time without self-realization of our divine inner core threatens us with burnout, hysteria, unhelpful rage, and the lack of strategic understanding and wisdom. Secondly, we need to marry a radical faith in the innate goodness of humanity, which is a divine gift, and the unanimous testimony, actually, of all the mystical traditions. We need to marry this with a respectful and shrewd acknowledgement of the potentially devastating power, brilliance, and seductiveness of the dark forces that are active and of the susceptibility of human nature to them. Radical faith in innate goodness on its own leads to idiot compassion, compassion that has no wisdom, no boundaries in the face of systemic evil and is characterized by the New Age, which has, in a sense, rotted the foundations of true sacred defiance because It's very concerned with just being nice, not resisting. However, acknowledgement of the power of evil and the power of its seductiveness without faith in human goodness can lead to terrible despair and to becoming, at worst, unconscious agents of the dark, which longs for humanity to despair of itself. Only a marriage between these two can provide us with the strength, stamina, and canniness that accepts our divine nature and works from that divine nature on the fragility, complexity, brokenness, and susceptibility to seduction of our human nature. And the third marriage is this. We must marry profound urgency, grounded in acknowledgement of the desperate nature of our situation in all levels of the world, with the mysterious peace and patience born out of a radical surrender to the intelligence of divine wisdom and divine love. Profound urgency without patience and inner peace will result in actions that the dark powers will use to justify our destruction. Cultivation of patience and peace without the inner fire of urgency will result in a fatal inability to act when necessary and a stupor that is justified in fake spiritual terms. If you just develop peace, patience, and surrender without being prepared to act from the urgent side of yourself, you will become a quietist who does not know that divine love requires wise action. And fourthly, as warrior midwife, we need to combine a capacity for heartbreak with a radical commitment to cultivating joy as our essential nature and the source of energy. If all you respond to is heartbreak, you'll be paralyzed. And if you try to cultivate joy without heartbreak, you'll be fed counterfeit joy. Jesus also warned that false prophets, and many other spiritual teachers have given us this warning as well, that false prophets can assume the form of angels. Comfortable happiness is readily available in a fascist state. Thus, we must discern, as Andrew calls it, the morphine drip of happiness from radical, subversive joy that makes us patient and guided revolutionaries of love. Now, of course, it's too early to fully imagine what a full-scale Trump presidency might look like, but there are disturbing early warning signs that could be harbingers of a destructive and powerful fascism such as I have been describing. What is most important to remember is that the potential for a more deadly fascism now exists. And when we add to this climate chaos, the annihilation of the planet is entirely possible and unimaginably probable. We live in a culture that is obsessed with happiness. Don't worry, be happy, we sing, and yet our happiness is circumstantial and can easily be undermined when things aren't going our way. All of the great spiritual traditions have taught us that happiness is not the same as joy, and they have shown us how to access the deep core of joy that resides within our being. My dear friend Andrew Harvey and I have recently released a beautiful book entitled Return to Joy, in which we not only clarify the difference between joy and happiness, but provide tools for accessing joy no matter what is occurring in our lives. Return to Joy is a compelling and potent invitation to the reader to consider that joy is the ultimate nature of reality and that its absence lies at the root of our current unprecedented global crisis. In this book, Andrew and I mine the mystical wisdom of the ages that places joy at the core of our existence and purpose as a species, moving forward to consider in depth the myriad enemies of joy in our time. As we tend the fires of joy, we celebrate its seven flames and nurture its ubiquitous presence, whether in the background or the foreground of our lives. Return to Joy is available on Amazon, the Barnes & Noble website, and through your local bookseller.
Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com.
So I have been talking about these three R's for responding to a future which may be extremely daunting, a future which may really look like a fascist state in the United States. We talked about the three R's of our response. First of all, reconnection, and then resistance, and finally, resilience. One of my favorite words these days, resilience. Now, we can safely assume that our future holds a significant degree of violence, as those who have unequivocally relied on their government and the conventional values of working hard and playing by the rules to redeem them begin to discover the extent to which they've been deceived. And you add to this deception, dispossession, and you have a powder keg of rage, which, if turned upon oneself, becomes suicidal, and if turned upon others, becomes socially volatile or even homicidal. But I say that rather than running from the room screaming as if our hair were on fire, let's use this incredibly teachable moment to learn some of the painful realities and profound existential lessons that this presidential election is attempting to teach us about resilience. First, and most of you listening to my voice right now know this, industrial civilization and the paradigm at its core, a paradigm of separation and disconnection from ourselves, from each other, and from the earth, is being shredded before our eyes, and there's no fixing it. It's done. And it may be that we're done as a species. But nevertheless, let's get on with service and compassion and sacred activism and a recommitment to doing our own deep inner work. Secondly, in order to get on with it, we need to ditch our denial and delusion and look squarely in the face of the sobering data, not only regarding the state of our culture, but the life support status of our dying planet. In a recent story from Cosmos magazine, we learned that, and this is the title of the article, sea urchins flip inside out to become an adult. The story continues by noting that the tiny babies spend their early life searching the vast depths of the ocean for a suitable home. But once they find one, they undergo an incredible transformation. I believe that it's now time to flip our consciousness inside out and become the adults that our catastrophic predicament is demanding us to be. We're going to be tested mightily, beyond perhaps anything we can now imagine within the next 4 years and perhaps longer. The next question is, how do we grow up to respond to this crisis or any crisis? After facing the full extent of it, allowing ourselves to know the sober data, we allow ourselves to grieve. We may need to sob, cry, rage, wail, scream. We may need to allow ourselves to be racked with remorse and regret. Because yes, we've colluded in creating this crisis, but it's not enough to beat ourselves up. We must recognize that without grieving, it doesn't matter one bit what we do or don't do in response to the crisis, because grief is love. And if we don't allow our hearts to be shattered with grief, we'll never touch the depths of love that are required for us to navigate the consequences of humankind's deranged choices. Choosing separation instead of love is what got us here in the first place. And above all else, our predicament is demanding radical heartbreak and astringent love and relentless reconnection with the divine within, reconnection with others and with the earth. We must also, as I've said in many places, commit to understanding and doing shadow work. For nearly 400 years, the United States has not dealt with the shadow of slavery. It's not dealt with the shadow of Native American genocide, now revisiting us at Standing Rock. Nor has it dealt with being the first nation to use nuclear weapons at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Nor has it recognized its repugnant imperialism and its obsessive proselytizing of the globe with corporate capitalism. Donald Trump is a shadow magnet. And like a poultice applied to an infected wound, he's drawn out the toxicity of our culture for all to behold. There are many, many resources available for doing shadow work. One resource, of course, is my book, Dark Gold, The Human Shadow and the Global Crisis, which you can find out more about at my website. Most importantly, when working with the shadow, we have to remember that not looking at it is not going to diminish it, but only increase its power until it has our undivided attention. And a Trump presidency is just one example. It's likely that this culture will become increasingly divided. Terrified, hurting people will continue to other their fellow humans and the ecosystems. Anger is likely to deepen. Violence may become epidemic. And if we're not doing grief work and shadow work, we will easily become enveloped in vengeance and retaliation, very well modeled for us by our new president. So in order to become whole as opposed to further divided, we must, and I mean must, create safe circles of connection and community with each other. Anyone who attempts to navigate the crisis on their own or just be with me and mine is not going to be able to navigate it. Now, at the same time that we face the crisis squarely, engage in grief work, shadow work, and create safe circles of community and support, we must regularly bathe in joy and beauty. In order to do so, it's essential to recognize the difference between circumstantial happiness and the permanent core of joy which lives within us. It may seem strange that humans need guidance in how to experience joy, but in a lifeless, flatline culture, we do. So for this reason, Andrew Harvey and I wrote our newly released book, Return to Joy, a Toolkit for Creating and Sharing Joy as the Ultimate Essence of Our Existence. And we chose not to release it until after the election, because we knew its message would be needed then more than ever, no matter who won. So there can be no authentic reconnection, no powerful resistance, and no long-lasting resilience without all three being grounded in a radical return to joy as our essential nature. Only through that return to joy will we find the energy to reconnect, the power to resist, and the strength to remain resilient, come what may. Now, I've referred to our divine core and our divine essence many, many times in this podcast. I'd like to kind of give it another language. And that is the language of the wonderful poet William Stafford in this very short little poem called The Way It Is. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing, and you have to explain about the thread. But it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. But you don't ever let go of the thread. There is a thread that runs through all of us. It is the source of our ability to reconnect, to resist, and to have resilience. And it is the source of radical joy. My wish for you at this holiday time or any time is that you reconnect deeply with that amazing, powerful thread that is within you, that is within all of us. Thank you so much for being with me today on this podcast. And until next time, be safe, be well, and by all means, be awake.
Thank you for joining us today. You can hear all podcasts and learn about Carolyn Baker's other works at www.carolynbaker.net. Her daily news digest is available by subscription and is delivered to your inbox 7 days per week with real news on economics, environment, geopolitics, civil liberties, and cultural issues, plus links to articles on inspiration and resilience. Come sail with us again next week on the Lifeboat Hour.